Welcome to Tempest in a Stockpot. I'm Christine Bruce.
And I'm Brenda Barrett.
And together, we've created 12 podcast episodes, each one agitating for change in Northern BC. In this, our preliminary episode, which we've entitled Small Mammals, we'll point to some of the food security themes we want to address in this series. Then, Jordan Baltitude, the Food Justice and Poverty Reduction Policy Analyst at Gordon House in Vancouver, will define food security, an old concept that's made a big resurgence because we've begun to view access to healthy food as a privilege when it should be a right for everyone. And finally, we'll end this episode with a spontaneous conversation I had with Dr. Teresa Healy, President of the Public Health Association of BC. Teresa will introduce the notion of equity in that right to food and how even a small mammal can make a big difference to how that plays out in our communities. Time to check the pot and see what's cooking. I lived in Witsit for a year, and for the purpose of attending their many feasts, I was assigned membership to the Tsayu or Beaver clan that officially makes me a small mammal. What difference could a small mammal possibly make to its environment? As the Wet'suwet'en will tell you, a lot. The North American beaver, Castor canadiensis, is considered a keystone species throughout Canada because it plays the role of an ecosystem engineer. Keystone species have been shown to impact their ecosystem disproportionate to their size. If a keystone species disappears, it causes a domino effect, which ultimately could mean an ecosystem collapse. Take the humble North American beaver. If the beaver disappeared in northern BC, their ecosystem, our ecosystem, would become drier, more prone to erosion. The loss of their dams would result in faster flowing, straighter rivers, increased flood and drought severity, and the disappearance of wetlands. The landscape would become less resilient to fire, and many species, including fish, would lose essential habitat. Small mammals like you and me can make a big difference, as you'll hear in today's episode. Here are some of the food security themes you're going to encounter in our 12-part series. Our society's outdated concept of philanthropy and the charity model, and how giving the food insecure some advocacy over their choices brings more dignity into a community. Where and how often the notion of equity falls apart, and how that should change. What diversity means here in the North, a vast, sparsely populated region with a unique demographic profile characterized by a higher-than-average Indigenous population and a significant diversity in smaller communities. Related to that, how the buzzword inclusion affects the North. Something the North excels at is building collaborations, and why those matter so much in a remote location. Training the next generation in food security, and how that brings a fresh way of thinking to the table. Mapping food justice, a topic that's no stranger to any community across Canada. While we never address things like purchasing groceries at gas stations and barriers to resources, you'll repeatedly hear how the smaller communities like Wet'suwet'en and Sikidak are ensuring that anyone can get fresh local produce year-round at their band offices. Surprising challenges with getting funding because of racism and stigma. And finally, how reconciliation doesn't mean becoming a white savior. Most people, regardless of skin color, don't want to be rescued. They want to be enabled to make their own choices. It's important that we look squarely at the truth of the situation and acknowledge, understand, and support the reality of the situation in our northern communities. Now I'd like to introduce Jordan Baltitude, the Food Justice and Poverty Reduction Policy Analyst at Gordon House in Vancouver.
I am Jordan. I'm the Food Justice and Poverty Reduction Analyst at Gordon Neighborhood House, which is a community-focused organization in the west end of Vancouver. Through my role there, I also coordinate the BC Regional Advocacy Network with Right to Food.
Jordan, I'm going to personalize this next question. I have been to several meetings recently where I introduce myself as a food security coordinator, and people somehow, their brains think I'm the caterer.
Yeah.
It seemed really important to me that we get somebody like yourself who can give us a definition of things like food security and food sovereignty so that someone who doesn't really understand what those two phrases mean has something to hang their hat on.
That's a main point of tension in our work. I feel like people, when you put the words food security together, they hear food or they hear security, and they don't really hear them together. when I talk about food security, people often think I mean agricultural biosecurity or Canada's ability to produce food. They're not really seeing these multiple dimensions of food security that exist. So that's an ongoing practice for us. For food security, I see it as having three main dimensions. There's the physical dimension that, you know, people and communities and nations have enough healthy, safe food to feed themselves, and that food is physically accessible to people. It's embedded in where they live, in their daily lives, and there's not undue burden placed on people to obtain the food that they need to live. So that's one dimension. Then there's the economic dimension, where people have enough money to afford to feed themselves and their communities. And then the third being like the social and cultural dimension, that people have access and are able to produce, grow, and harvest foods that fit within their cultural contexts and traditions and diets that are best suited for their bodies and their ways of living. And this, you know, also plays into building community around food and food acting as a point of connection for many, many people. And I think that that's an essential component of food and to, you know, thriving and living long, healthy lives is that social piece which we build around food. And then sovereignty, I think, is all of those things, but it also adds a layer around governance and rights. It focuses on, you know, people's ability to define their own food and agriculture systems, foods and systems that are healthy and culturally appropriate and produced through ecologically sustainable and suitable methods. And I also think it's hard to separate, you know, especially in our current context, it's difficult to separate the context of food sovereignty from Indigenous food sovereignty, which has, you know, a lot to do with the act of land back and restoring governance over the lands and waters and air to the people that have stewarded that land for thousands and thousands of years and relinquishing that colonial control that we, you know, settlers of Canada and the Canadian government have put onto our food systems. So that historical context, I think, is, you know, when we're defining food sovereignty, I think that that's a core element of the definition of how we define food sovereignty, how we see it and practice it. So it's not simple or straightforward. It's more like an essay on it than it is like a concrete definition. But that piece is definitely an ongoing challenge for people who do this work. So yeah, still working on that piece.
Well, whenever I get into a conversation with people over this, I have to point out that the fact that we can't even make a clear definition of these two phrases demonstrates how politicized our food is. And the fact that we can't just all eat, there's no equity there. The fact that we need sovereignty, there's no diversity there. There's no inclusion there. It's an incredibly politicized situation. And I don't want to be rude to anybody, but I would really like everyone who's listening to navel gaze on this, because if you don't understand those phrases, maybe it's a question of your privilege, because you've never been food insecure. So you've never had to think about that. So maybe it's time to go to the bathroom and just sit and think about this for a minute.
Absolutely. I think that's a great point.
But I appreciate your definitions, Jordan. They're comprehensive.
Honestly, one of the biggest challenges for me, and especially when I work with people with lived and living experience, they don't necessarily describe their access to food using these terms. You know, they're not necessarily using the words food security when talking about the challenges and barriers that impact their ability to eat. I think hunger is a word that comes up a lot, you know, in my research with folks and when I'm having conversations with folks. But, you know, when we think about that politically, like that doesn't necessarily get at that the root causes, like the word hunger, you know, it's a very individualized feeling. And so it continues to sort of individualize, it perpetuates a narrative that food insecurity and poverty are individualized problems, which they're not. They're systemic and political. So it's really tough to figure out, you know, like how we can best find that language. I don't think we have it yet. Yeah, hopefully we can build on these, you know, we can find language that is descriptive, but also accessible, I think is just the ongoing challenge.
In several of our conversations, universal basic income has been referenced as a way to support a more equitable and sustainable food system for both eaters and producers. Can you give a brief overview of what UBI is?
Most of what I know comes from groups like Basic Income Canada and Basic Income BC, who've been researching and advocating on this for years. So I'm going to lean on their definitions. But Basic Income Canada defines basic income as something like an unconditional cash transfer from government to individuals to enable everyone to meet their basic needs and participate in society, regardless of their work status. And I think it can be really confusing when talking about basic income because everyone sort of understands the concept, but the way in which it's implemented sort of differs a lot. So there are two major models that people refer to when they talk about basic income. The first is a universal model, and I think this is ultimately the core of what people talk about when they talk about UBI. It provides the same dollar amount to every person, regardless of their other income. And often in this model, those that have higher sources of income elsewhere, the income that they receive through the government, through the basic income program, might be taxed back to make up for the payment. So it will go out to them, but it might be clawed back by the government to sort of balance out the system. So that's my understanding of one model. And the second model is, I think it's also called the guarantee model. So in this model, your other income that you receive through your job or elsewhere is considered upfront. And so if that income is low, you receive the full amount of the basic income program. But as your income rises, the benefit gradually decreases. And at a certain point, you'll pass the income threshold and make enough money where you won't receive any of the benefit. I think a lot of benefits in Canada already work this way. The seniors benefit and the Canada child benefit and the Ontario basic income pilot use this model as well. It gets at the income piece and the poverty piece, which is one of the main root causes of food insecurity.
I think sometimes even getting to that feels very ideal. So are there certain policies and steps that, say, Right to Food Canada and the network of partners are advocating for at this point that move us forward? And I'm just curious, there have been the recent announcements related to automatic tax filling. Is that a step towards making this more possible?
It can feel really overwhelming to pick one or two policy ideas here and there to advocate for when food insecurity is so interconnected to so many different systems like housing and income and climate change and Indigenous rights and food sovereignty. There's so much that anyone can focus on. How do you decide where to put your limited energy? As a coalition or network, I think it's really important to put parameters around your main advocacy goals and decide, you know, what policy agenda is realistic for your capacity and aligned with your values. So the Regional Networks Project through Right to Food was launched to primarily focus on advancing systemic changes that tackle the root causes of food insecurity. Like, we know that we have enough food to feed everyone, but the affordability and the access of that food is the thing that creates food insecurity. So we wanted to get at that when deciding what advocacy priorities to focus on. We also take a federal approach because it's a national crisis and it does require a coordinated national response and pressure put on the federal government. And that's also the jurisdiction of the government that all of our Right to Food partners have in common. It's a way for all of us to work towards a collective goal that really impacts everyone in the network. And another parameter is that we wanted to center people aged 18 to 64 in our advocacy efforts because currently, this is a group that experiences disproportionate levels of food insecurity, but receives very little targeted support. There's a lot of stigma and stereotypes and ableism and outdated notions about the labor market that shape public opinion and government policies. And so we saw a gap in advocacy for folks in this age range. So this is the focus that shaped the approach that we're currently taking to address food insecurity at the national level. And that boils down to three main policy priorities. The first one is a dignified income floor. Income is one of the strongest predictors of food insecurity. And we see a dignified income floor as the means to ensuring that everyone has enough to meet their basic needs through stronger targeted income supports. So this approach builds on supports that already work and exist and enhances them by expanding benefits and accessibility. And it also opens the door for new initiatives like a groceries and essentials benefit to fill urgent gaps. So it can be difficult for any policy to be seen as a quote unquote quick win, especially with the government right now that is choosing to make the focus of this budget, you know, austerity and saving money and making sacrifices. And that's, you know, a lot of the language that's being used around this budget. So it's difficult to envision any new income policy as being a quick win, but we've seen MPs be open to this policy idea and adding additional benefits and strengthening that income floor. So that's where we feel there is momentum to put our energy right now. So that's one of our main policy priorities. The second one really focuses on advancing Indigenous food sovereignty. We know Indigenous peoples experience some of the highest rates of food insecurity, and that has its roots in historical and ongoing colonial laws and practices. There's an Indigenous network that works with Right to Food and Indigenous-led community food centers that are sort of driving this work. We've heard time and again that food security can't be solely defined by individual income in the context of Indigenous communities and Indigenous food sovereignty. The solutions must go beyond government cash transfers and take on those root causes. And that looks like collective access to land and food and governance, which are essential components of Indigenous health and security. And those aren't an optional supplement to income-based policy. It's a vital part of nation-to-nation relationships and reconciliation. So Right to Food has this ongoing campaign right now called Seeds of Sovereignty, developed in partnership with the Indigenous Network and Indigenous-led CFCs who have built on them and put them into 6 concrete policy suggestions, like investing in and protecting Indigenous food systems and creating paid roles for hunters and knowledge keepers who are upholding Indigenous ways of being, doing, and harvesting. And I just mentioned this because the report and the policy asks are coming out very soon, and it'll be on Right to Food's website. And then the third policy priority is strong public infrastructure. So acknowledging that along with income and Indigenous food sovereignty, we support strong public systems and encourage the federal government to invest in childcare, housing, pharmacare, dental care, and other community supports that lower costs for households. These investments, you know, like really reduce pressures for workers and people that are living on low and fixed incomes and protect against financial shocks. And this framing of reducing cost of living really resonates with a lot of the people that I work with who have lived and living experiences of food insecurity and poverty. That's a big constant pressure that's felt. And so when they're using limited time and resources to engage in advocacy, that's emerges as a priority for them. That's where we want to put in our time and our energy, is focusing on how can we bring that cost of living down so that public infrastructure plays a really, really big role in bringing that cost of living down. So that's a big priority as well. So those are the 3 main priorities. And just noting for a second, the announcement from Prime Minister Carney on automatic tax filing for low-income Canadians, we definitely welcome it as a sign of progress. And, you know, that can be a huge point of stress and additional time, particularly for people in precarious and low paid employment situations. So it will definitely help, but we don't feel it's enough. And we'll continue to like ask for more. When we talk to the federal government about our policy priorities, we don't really feel like it gets at that root cause piece. So we'll turn the attention back to the other 3 priorities that we have.
As an individual citizen, eater, someone who cares but has limited time, it's not my job to be involved in systemic change and policy, what can I do? If I think this is what I want to see my politicians, the people I voted for, doing, how can I support this movement? Does it matter to write a letter to the editor? What are the steps that an individual person can take?
And are there things on the personal level that you can be doing in your everyday life?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like not just with your politician, but you personally in your community.
Yeah. Like, does it matter if I write a letter? It's everything. Government responds to public opinion. They pass policy that is not necessarily grounded in evidence or the best long-term outcomes or the most efficient use of money. Like, they respond to what people are thinking in the current moment. We're seeing that, I think, a lot in the direction that our immigration policy is taking, that there's this cultural racism that's going on and scapegoating of immigrants as the root cause of our economic problems that we're experiencing right now, or we see in our day-to-day lives. And our government's passing more restrictive immigration policies, even though that's, you know, we very much know that that has nothing to do with our economic challenges. I hate to use a negative example when talking about this, but it goes to show the impact that public opinion has on policy. We absolutely need to mobilize to write letters, to make noise, to be really, really loud about the things that we believe in and we care about. And I understand that in our capitalist system, we've been isolated in a way and our time is being spent in ways that makes it really difficult to take the time that's needed to engage with these systems. So I think just understanding what your capacity is and engaging however you can. You know, if you want to sign a petition, if you want to sign an open letter, there's even platforms that have been built where you click on the link, you add your name at the end, and it will send a letter to your representative. There are a lot of tools that are making it easier to engage. And so if you really don't have very much time, just a simple Google search and what you're interested in, you will find people doing that work. You will find ways to engage. And if you have more time, then joining groups that are in your communities that are doing this work, meeting up in person, attending protests, being visible in front of government, I think is really, really impactful. Showing the strength in numbers physically and visibly. Speaking to council, I know I've worked with a lot of people who are, I've never spoken to council and are really, you know, quite intimidated by the act of doing so, but I guarantee you that council cares way, way more about what you have to say than they do about what academics have to say. They care way more about your experience, and your experience is so important in that, such an important piece of that puzzle. So yes, there's lots that can be done, and I definitely encourage people to just read, do a little bit of research, and you'll find it quite easily.
And if this doesn't resonate with you, where you're worried about how other people's rights are going to affect you, maybe having a little bit of a conversation with yourself around the privilege you've had that you've never had to worry about these topics and what you can extend to others, that we're so worried that extending rights to others means it's going to be less for ourselves. And it's so not true.
I have seen so much get done through mobilized mutual aid networks. Like in Victoria, there is a group called Community Food Support that is entirely volunteer run, and they recruit people to source food, put it together, deliver it. Basically, there are people who are mobilizing and taking action and are not waiting for policy to change because policy can be slow. So in addition to getting involved in advocating for that systemic long-term piece, you can also help by feeding people in your community every day. If especially if you have the privilege and the power and the capacity to do that, it makes such a difference. And we can't forget that in the center of our work is keeping people fed. That's the main thing.
You are listening to Tempest in a Stockpot. I'm Christine Bruce.
And I'm Brenda Barrett.
In the first half of this episode, I explained some of the food security themes you're likely to hear in our 12-episode podcast series, so you know what to expect in future episodes. And to ensure that our working definition of food security reflects the current understanding across Canada, we invited Jordan Bultitude of Gordon Neighbourhood House in Vancouver to that conversation. To end this episode, a casual conversation I had with Dr. Teresa Healy, President of the Public Health Association of BC, whose perspective on the importance of small animals, like beavers, will provide much-needed context for your contribution to these conversations.
I grew up poor. I left school at 14. I ran away from home. I was on the streets. I did drugs. And I started university at 28 with two kids. So part of me is still very strong that PhD is meaningless, and also that it can count.
What you come from, the experiences you have, affects how you work with policy now. And I'm the same way. This morning I went out to the car to get something, and there were homeless people, and I came in and I said, I need some food.
Yeah.
I can't go back into this food security conference where everybody's comfortable and just ignore the fact that I've seen some homeless people.
To me, that's where we're actually living what we believe. At every level, it permeates everything you do. It isn't something that you choose to do. It's like you were saying earlier, that you, some days the despair, how do you get out of bed? Well, the fact is you still got out of bed. You know, you can't not. Like you said, you couldn't have come back in here without addressing that moment.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, we are all driven somehow.
And I think that's what Audre Lorde said that, you know, really spoke to me, was voice over silence, truth over lies, compassion over cruelty. Those are what drive the best of us as humans.
Mm-hmm. I have three grandchildren. I would like to be remembered as a person who is driven by those values. Mm-hmm. I want my grandchildren to say, well, she may not have succeeded in big ways, but she continued to follow those values in her life.
Yeah.
And
it
was meaningful, her life.
She didn't betray them.
Yes.
Yeah. And in the end, for me, it's not whether we succeeded or failed. And I think it was Gandhi who said, it doesn't matter what you do. What matters is you do it.
Yeah.
Because as you and I were talking earlier, the first real defeat is if we give up. If
yes.
we lose hope, then
yes.
they've won.
Exactly.
And as long as we have hope, they haven't.
Yeah. Yeah, I think this is really significant that there are a lot of people feeling this way. We don't always realize it. We feel so siloed and isolated in the work that we do. I mean, whenever I get up to speak, I usually start with, I'm a small mammal. What can a small mammal do? Because we all feel like this, we're powerless.
Yes.
But in fact, we can. You do five small things and they become a powerful force, those five small things.
Oh, absolutely.
And there are waves of impact on other people. And they do five small things, and suddenly you've got this tsunami started.
And the fact that we have the tsunami and we're really excellent surfers with good surfboards.
Yes.
We can ride those waves and not be destroyed by them. And I think that's something that, you know, the society in general seems to impose on us, is that we are powerless. What we do doesn't make a difference. You know, don't bother voting. What's that going to do?
Yes.
I mean, we get taught and trained to actually see ourselves as powerless, to see ourselves as, you know, it's not worth it. You're not worth it. And I know that taking on the world, it seems impossible. There's no way I'm going to dislodge Trump. But if I don't stop trying to do something here in my neck of the woods, then I'm enabling. Enabling that
exactly.
horror to continue.
Yes.
So we have to find that place where we can stand and say, this is where I fight. This is where it matters to me. And I think food is so fundamental to human beings that it's, to me, a natural place where we come together. And it also means, for me, I mean, there's a reason why Jesus Christ had a Last Supper. I mean, food builds relationships. It's healing. It brings us together. And Northern BC has been really big on, you know, community potlucks and coming together around food. It's a natural for us. And, you know, you're living in a small community and you get known for a particular dish that everybody wants you to bring to the community potluck because everybody looks forward to it. So you get your place in community, in the growing and the giving and the sharing and the eating of food. To me, that's such a fundamental human need. It also infuriates me that it's not a human right.
It is infuriating, isn't it?
It is.
Because you'll die if you don't eat.
Exactly.
So it should be a basic human need and part of that fundamental list.
And what we end up with is the really cheap food actually kills people.
It does. Yes.
And the good, healthy food is so expensive.
So, but it doesn't need to be.
It doesn't need to be.
They've empowered that.
Capitalism. You can make money off anything.
Yes.
So we make things for profit that, in fact, should be human rights. You should have the right to good, healthy food.
Do you know, one of the things that I did last summer, I had a table at our farmer's market, and it was called Everybody Eats.
Yeah.
And it was an educational table. But I always brought a sample of something. You know, I would make some fruit leather, for instance.
Yeah.
And anybody could come and try it. And then we would talk about how you use your dehydrator. But I became known as the woman who gives out free snacks. And sometimes the precariously housed would come to the table, and they would ask me, of course, and I would give them a big chunk of it.
Yeah.
And that's not the business model that farmers markets are built on. They're there to sell food. But I made sure that what I was handing out was not something somebody was selling, so I wasn't compromising their business.
Or competition.
But I brought in more people. And, you know, the vendors sometimes would say to me, but you're bringing in homeless people. And I say, yes, because they're citizens and they need to eat. And so I'm dislodging some of those assumptions that we've always made.
I remember doing an evaluation of an HIV/AIDS project in Northern BC, and I remember the receptionist at the school, this is a small community, complaining because the condoms kept being stolen, and she wanted to put them somewhere else and she would give them out. And to me, the fact that being stolen is actually, this is a good thing.
You've distributed them.
The young people are taking them. But if you put them down and they have to ask, they're not going to.
They're not going to because that's embarrassing. There's stigma involved.
Yeah. And I said, so the fact that they're stealing to me as your evaluator, that's a sign of a success.
Yes.
They trust enough to come here and get them and use them. And you are doing an excellent job. So, but that thinking, right, that you've got to pay for something or you've got to earn it somehow. And certainly with my research on the 1930s, that notion of lesser eligibility, that anything charity, or as it was called back then, anything relief gave you had to be of less value than the lowest paid job. Because the assumption was you would avoid taking a job and go on relief. Because you got more money than, you know, sweeping the streets would pay you $2 an hour. Relief better be $1 an hour so that it would drive people to work. that is a principle. It goes all the way back to the Elizabethan period, to Henry VIII, this notion of the poorhouse. You could be taken in by the poorhouse, but they were going to make it impossible and horrible to live there. So it would force you to take these jobs that paid less and were less status, because otherwise people wouldn't do those jobs.
The assumption that nobody wants to work, a lot of it is outhouse luck. Your job vanished, and now you don't have a job. It's not that you don't want a job. Yeah. It's not that you're not looking for something meaningful to do and the ability to support yourself. It's that luck has gone against you, or your health has failed, or this is it's
human reasons.
Disturbing that we feel that we have to impose these levels of inequity on each other.
Well, certainly, I think in the 1930s that was a radicalization process, because when you lined up for relief, your neighbors were lining up with you, and you knew that that neighbor wasn't a lazy bum. You knew that that husband and father had worked really hard and really cared for his wife and kids, and he's in the lineup too. So the lies about you're just lazy and you just want the state to look after you, I think there was a great radicalization that happened. It's not been well described in history. There was a group in Vancouver called the Vancouver Mothers Council. It's probably a communist hotbed. And they actually did a big demonstration. They had a picnic. All the unemployed, they call them boys, the unemployed men and boys would come, and they'd feed them. And then they got them to line up in the shape of a heart, and then they lined themselves up around the outside. So people began to understand there was something wrong with the system and began to push back. And that story of the women who occupied City Hall to protest this document that they were supposed to sign, that signed away their human rights.
Yeah, you know, it always annoys me when somebody considers charity an act where I'm allowed to give you something, but you darn well better be grateful for it, even if it's just something that I don't particularly want, or it's expired food, or...
Yeah. You should be really grateful to me, because if you're not, then you don't deserve it.
There's something wrong with you. That's right.
Yeah.
Instead of being able to say, well, actually, I have allergies to that, or, you know, I have lots of that, but I really need this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we don't allow each other to have a little bit of agency over our food choices.
Well, before the introduction of the poorhouse and the principle of lesser eligibility, actually, Charitas, there's faith, hope, and Charitas, and the greatest of these is Charitas, is love. It used to be, if I was living in a parish and we didn't have any poor people to feed and take care of, we had to go and find some. Because how could you demonstrate Charitas, this love that God is expecting you to portray and to give, if you've got no poor people to do it to? So there was this notion that we looked after each other, and it wasn't shameful. And I don't know how many novels you can read where the lady of the manor goes out with baskets full of food because she's supposed to, right? And you take down fruits from the greenhouse to the poor widow. And
we encourage people to come and glean the fields. Yes.
In fact, the first food bank was in Edmonton, and that organization called itself the Gleaners.
Yes. So there were a couple of comments that you made in your speech this morning. One of them was your emphasis on local being so significant.
I think it's really important to understand that, yes, these are all complex problems, wicked problems. They are problems at a scale that we can't work with, we can't deal with, we can't see a way in. But the answer is local. If local areas focus on what works for them, then that's the answer. And, you know, I referred to Jared Diamond's book, which was all about how different societies emerged and why some developed iron implements and some didn't. It was to do with the geography, and that you dealt with what you were dealt, which was, this is the environment, what will grow here? And every gardener deals with this every spring. What grew here last year and did well, and what perished over there? That's the epitome of local for me. It's that local knowledge, local ingenuity, local experimentation, we figure out what works. And we find what works, and we make it work for us. It also means there's a political system around us that would strangle us at birth. There's all kinds of power struggles, But I mean, what happened in the 1930s, and one of the reasons they were so successful is because when Saskatoon started its relief store, it put itself in competition with all the other grocery stores. And without customers, those grocers were going to end up on relief as well. And so the grocers and landlords, because if the relief was going to pay your rent for you, they were going to do it at the lowest cost, and landlords couldn't survive. So you're actually going to increase the relief role with people who were currently working and currently trying to contribute and make a living. And so you ended up with this unexpected alliance between unemployed workers and unemployed mothers and fathers, and who might normally be seen as, you know, the middle class. They're not going to support, you know, these radical rabble rousers who, you know, want to increase their charity. The line between on relief and off relief was really narrow. And I think today one of our issues has been that the gap between the rich and the poor is so wide now, you don't see it. And a lot of the middle class don't realize that some of the policies they think are benefiting them eventually won't. And they are actually going to join the lower working class. It was Gloria Steinem who always said, you're one man away from being unemployed. And one I read recently is, you're one punch in the face away from, and that's referring to the political battles going on right now. You're out on the streets and you're going to get punched in the face by an ICE agent all of a sudden.
Oh, yes.
You understand, you're on that side.
Right.
So the violence, you're only one act of violence away from the attack of the state.
Yeah. I am disturbed at how politicized food has become, but I mean, almost everything has become politicized now. People can't help themselves anymore.
Yeah. Well, and I think that's the thing for me, is that the industrial food system became so all-pervasive. You know, it's why there's McDonald's in Russia. I mean, we have been able to say, okay, you can have this food, it's cheap, it's tasty, and people buy into that. And it's diminished the power of local. And the reality is, I think COVID, for all of its horrors, it did reveal how inadequate industrial food is. And the fact that we got trained to like tomatoes that looked really plump and firm, they're bred that way, so they can travel long distances. Yeah. The nutrition is less. They don't have any taste. I lived in Mozambique for 2 years with my then husband and my kids. When we came back, the kids wouldn't eat bananas because they didn't taste like a banana.
Right.
In Mozambique, they had pieces of fruit, mangoes, peaches, avocados, bananas, all the time.
And the final comments that you made, they really touched everyone in the room. I think it was because they were so heartfelt.
Yeah. I wish the people in rooms like this could see themselves the way I see them. Because I think you get caught up in the daily grind, the daily struggle. You just do these things. But there's no place that lets you step back and see that, excuse my language, you're fucking amazing. What you do is so necessary. And to find the courage and the strength and the power to keep coming back when everybody would slam you to the ground, you know, like, we don't see that. We're too busy doing what has to be done every day. The fact that you keep going back and doing it anyway, like the farmers in Saskatchewan, they went out every spring, no matter how bad things were, and they kept planting. And those were dust storms and droughts and wheat policies. They were being strangled at every turn, and they kept going. And that, I think, brings us back to that place where we began, which is that you have to do it. You have to keep believing in yourself, right? It's that commitment. And I think for food activists, there's something particularly feisty. And I think because it's particularly real. When people go hungry, they can die. They can be diminished. And so I think there's something in front of us that you can't look away from.
And we have particular challenges in the North, and people address those anyway, as a community.
Yeah.
And I value that. And I, you know, you commented that you've become more fearless. Well, I think that food activists, when they're in the game for a while, they do lose their fear and they become more confident and they do speak out more courageously.
Yes. And I also think with age, I mean, this is just my own experience, but I spent a lot of my life feeling like I didn't belong. I've done things and then only later step back and look, the hell was somebody should have stopped that,
yeah.
Right? And they didn't. I did my PhD and then I came up here for a year to teach at UMBC and ended up staying. I abandoned that journey of tenure track. I just wanted to be here. And I look back and think, what the hell? And I think you get to a point where you start to think, I have to do what's right. Yeah. It doesn't matter what other people think.
Yeah, or the journey that I've been trained to think that this is what I'm supposed to do. Here I am on this other journey, let's just do it.
And that you don't lose it. At some point, the heart that you had that said as a little girl on the playground being bullied because you're Irish and Roman Catholic and poor, this isn't fair. That this isn't fair at the playground doesn't leave you.
Yeah.
That just fundamental capacity to see injustice and name it. And try to do something about it.
So that nobody else has to deal with that. To be hungry on the street and homeless and neglected and dismissed.
And put down. I know that I've done a lot of work with the street folk here. And many of the young people using drugs, yes, they get addicted at some point. But they begin because it quells the pangs of hunger.
Yes, it's a coping mechanism.
Yeah, and it keeps you alive.
Yes.
Yeah, and then we've got people who say they're drug addicts, they're going to steal and break into the garden shed, never thinking that, you know what, if we brought these young people together and fed them and gave them things to do. I remember we did get some funding and did this work with Feed People on the Street, and I remember one guy saying to me, it isn't that we just need to be fed. He said, we need to have something to do.
Mm-hmm.
He said, if you can give me a workshop on that, about how to have a healthy relationship, or how to manage my money, and you do that, and you feed me, and you treat me with respect, that's what I need.
Yeah. These programs that have people working in the fields so that they can feed themselves, so that they can go home at night and feel that they've done something meaningful.
And that you are fed and respected as a human being.
Yes.
That notion that, yeah, there's crime, yeah, there's drug addiction and all of these things, but a lot of it is boredom. And not belonging and not having a place.
And not having any other options. They're stealing food. Well, they have no other way of getting food.
Oh,
Les Miserables started there, you know. He stole bread for his nephew because there was no other way to get the nephew fed.
We shoplifted a lot because we wouldn't eat any other way. And David, bless his heart, stole journals for me. I've got journals. I started writing with a fountain pen and a lovely journal because he stole them for me. I've still got them. In fact, at the archives at the university is going to put together what they call a FONDS, F-O-N-D-S, and it means a collection of your stuff, and they're going to look at my, they're looking at, of course, all my teaching stuff and my research stuff, but they're interested in my journals.
And I love that.
The first two journals were stolen. Well, my last words to everybody who listens to the podcast is go on, don't give up, continue to stir up the shit, continue to do what you think is right and just, because the way the society is structured, they would crush you, and what is unjust and wrong would prevail. So don't give up. It doesn't matter what happens tomorrow or next week, what happens is cumulative of everybody continuing to fight.
Be that small mammal.
Be the small mammals. They're important. Everybody overlooks the hedgehog.
This podcast was funded by the Public Health Association of BC. Brenda Barrett is my co-lead and the executive director of the Storytellers Society in Hazelton. Technical production by me, Christine Bruce. Music by Elijah Larson. Our food experts today were Jordan Bultitude of Gordon Neighborhood House in Vancouver and Dr. Teresa Healy, who just happens to be the president of the Public Health Association of BC. For more information on this or any other episode of Tempest in a Stockpot, visit storytellerssociety.org/tempest. Thank you for sharing this meal with us. We're looking forward to eating many future meals with you. I'm Christine Bruce, reminding you to stir that pot and be that small mammal with all your might.